Hi everyone, good afternoon. I'm just going to go ahead and get started. Thank you for joining us today for the DWC Carrier Quarterly Update. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Kate Sidora and I've been at DWC for about 8 years. I currently serve as our Public Information Officer on the Communications team. As Commissioner Nelson gets settled into his new role, I will be taking over some external relation duties. I wanted to go ahead and get a quick look at the topics that we'll be covering today. And just as a reminder, to please stay muted during the presentations so that everyone can hear everyone as clearly as possible. There is time allotted at the end of each presentation, and then again at the end of the meeting for any questions you may have for us. So let's go ahead and get started and kick things off with a welcoming remarks from our new Commissioner of Workers' Compensation, Jeff Nelson.
Thanks, Kate. For those of you that don't know Kate, like she said, she's been our public information officer for the past 8 years. She's done a really good job here. And she, as she mentioned, she's going to be taking over some of my old responsibilities. She's going to be our new director of external and media relations. So any questions that you have previously sent to me, you can of course still send those to me, but you can also get in touch with her. She might be a little quicker to respond. And her email is kate.sidora@tdi.texas.gov. And I think she's going to put it in the chat. You might also notice that I'm recording this meeting right now. That's going to be something we do moving forward. We're going to be recorded and posted on our website, so people who are unable to attend can go back and watch those. So good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. I may be a familiar face to some of you since I've been at the division for the past 6.5 years and I've sort of run these meetings in the past. But for those that don't know me that well, I thought I'd give a little bit of my background. I've been involved in the legislature in some form or fashion since 2005. Even when I was in college, I was a messenger for the Texas Senate, and I also worked for the UT System Office of Government Relations. After college, I went to go work for my hometown senator, Senator Tommy Williams, and I worked for him for 5 years doing insurance issues, including workers' comp and a lot of focus on TWIA as well. After my time with Senator Williams, I went to go work for Governor Rick Perry as his executive aide, both in his official capacity as governor and also on his second presidential campaign. After my time with Governor Perry, I moved over to the Division of Workers' Comp. Like I said, I've been here for the past 6 years. It's where I've gotten to know many of you in my role as the Director of External Relations, and it's where I've really dug into workers' comp policy. Been very involved in all the legislation that's gone on at the Capitol and all the various rule projects that we've done over the years. So while I might not be as knowledgeable as some of you on the call, I feel like I am somewhat of a subject matter expert when it comes to workers' comp, at least for legislative purposes and things like that. And now I'm honored to have been appointed as commissioner by Governor Abbott. So I know a lot of you are probably hoping to hear about my plans and my vision for the future for the next several years and, you know, the direction I plan to take DWC. I've been in this position for 23 calendar days, so bear with me a little bit longer as I sort of develop those thoughts. But what I can say is that I don't really intend to be making any major changes in the immediate future. My predecessors, Commissioner Brown, as well as Commissioner Brandon, made some significant changes to DWC and the system as a whole that have really positioned us and the system very well. Commissioner Brown in particular set DWC up well with some long-term projects that we've been able to continue to work on for the past 11 months while this position was vacant. And fortunately for me, having come from DWC, have been working on these issues for the past several years, we really haven't had to press pause and slow anything down. Some of these projects are kind of technical, so I think that's been a big help that I've been able to hit the ground running. And I just kind of want to walk through a few of those projects so you have an idea of where my focus has been and where it will be, you know, the next several months and really the next year. Now, for starters, we have our EDI rule and reporting project that's been in the works for 3+ years now. You all know this, but the switch from the EDI reporting standard 1.0 to 3.1 was necessary because the current standard is no longer going to be supported. Over the next year, as we work to implement this, we will work very closely with carriers and other stakeholders to make it as smooth as possible. And I am aware of some of the concerns out there about using a data collection agent and passing those costs along to insurance carriers. I can say 3 years ago when we were reviewing this very thoroughly, under Commissioner Brown, excuse me, the decision was made that this was the most cost-effective way to do this, both for DWC and for stakeholders. The alternatives are actually a lot more expensive and time-consuming, so I think this is a net win in the end for everybody. Another major project that I'm working on is our designated doctor rules. This is a very unique program that Texas has to offer, and I think trying to make it as good as possible is very important. The efforts we are doing right now to reduce, The efforts we are undertaking right now will reduce the administrative burdens for DDs, create reasonable testing requirements, and ensure quality designated doctor reports. Another project that I'm working on, what's our office move to the new Barbara Jordan complex downtown. This is something I literally walked into 2 weeks ago, but luckily our team was well prepared for the transition. One aspect of this move that's going to affect a lot of you is our field office is going to be moving here as well. That means our proceedings will be held in this office. For now, proceedings are going to stay at our office by the airport, but when they do move here, I do just want to say this is a downtown office. Parking's not going to be as easy as it was there. We will be putting out information on access to the building and parking as it becomes available. But for now, you know, just something we are all going to have to adjust to. It's a downtown office building. You're going to be parking in a parking garage and walking a little bit of ways. So those are a few of the things I've been working on, but I have put some thought toward the future. And the future to me looks like legislative session. I know session starts in January, but work at the division has already started. For example, last week, our legislative appropriations request was due. And what that is, that's a preliminary budget that we send to the legislature to give them an idea of what we're going to be requesting this year. That was due last Friday. We have a committee hearing coming up in September where we're going to be discussing that budget in a little more detail. Some other things that we're working on to prepare for the legislative session are legislative recommendations. We are statutorily required to send legislative recommendations to the legislature and our committees of jurisdiction each session. Earlier this year, we solicited input from stakeholders to gather, you know, their thoughts and ideas. We are just now starting that process to review those, and we will be putting those out and probably having more discussion about those in November. But that report is due to the legislature on December 1st of this year. We also have two interim charges that we've been working on. Some of you may remember a committee hearing from May of this year where these charges came up. The charges are related to first responders, which isn't very surprising. The first is about Senate Bill 22, which was the COVID-19 presumption bill. And the committee has asked us to take a look at that and really just provide them data on how that bill has been implemented. The other topic is workers' compensation claims for first responders in general. The committee has asked us to do a pretty in-depth review and study for this charge. So our research and evaluation group has been working on it for the past several months, and we hope to get that report to the committee sometime this fall. While I'm on the topic of the legislature, and because it's my background, I thought I'd give you a little idea of some issues that we might see this session. And again, I don't think it's going to change from the past few. I think it's going to be a lot of first responders. I think there's going to be a push to expand their coverage in some way. This could include expanding their eligibility options for lifetime income benefits. That's something that's been filed the past three sessions at least, and I would anticipate them doing that again. We may see them try to broaden the presumption statutes, whether it's additional conditions or, you know, changing some of the requirements to qualify for presumption. And then I think broadening the definition of first responders. I think there's going to be a push to try to include other classes of employees into the definition, which would open up for those additional benefits that first responders receive. We could also see a few other issues that don't have to do with first responders from last session. There was a pretty big push for a statutory pay increase for designated doctors. There was a push to have the legislature conduct a study of our treatment guidelines. And there was also a bill filed for 24-hour coverage policies for work and non-work related injuries. So those are a few of the things that I'm focused on here. But, you know, I did just want to say I've been here for 23 days. I'm meeting with all our program areas, doing a top to bottom approach to see what's going on, to see what can be improved. You know, I always think there's ways to make changes to improve efficiency and effectiveness. And I know the industry is always changing. There's technology changes that are going on constantly. And us as the regulator, we need to make sure we are keeping up with those changes. So, you know, with that said, I'm always willing and eager to listen to your thoughts and opinions on what's going on in the system. That's been my background. My background is in compromise and consensus building. That's what I've learned from all, you know, my predecessors in the past, and it's something I want to continue. So if you see something is going on or have a concern or you think there's a way that we can improve the system, I want to hear about it. I want to learn about it. So please reach out and let me know. We might not always agree in the end, but I will always, you know, have an open ear for anything like that. And with that, before I turn it over to Deborah Knight to really kick this off, I do just want to say we hold these meetings for you all, but we try to get some information out of it as well. So if you guys have those thoughts or questions now, it's a really good opportunity. You have a lot of DWC all together, a lot of DWC staff all together in one place. So please try to take advantage of that as we go through this meeting. And with that, I'll turn it over to Deborah Knight.
Thank you. As Commissioner mentioned, my name is Deborah Knight, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Compliance and Investigations. My area consists of four areas, so those of you who have been in these meetings before kind of know about it, but just in case, I'll go ahead and set the framework. I have the Audits and Investigations area, and they do audits and investigations. Cute name, right? Investigate, but really they investigate the allegations of administrative violations, or better known as complaints, and they perform audits. The enforcement area, and they prosecute administrative violations. The fraud investigations unit, which investigates criminal fraud within our system, and the fraud prosecutions area, which prosecutes those under the DA's authority here in Travis County. So that's my three areas, and we'll talk briefly about those the next slides. Okay, next slide. So we'll start off with the audits and investigations area, or complaints. Just to kind of let everybody know, we have Daryl Cooper, who had been in that area and had been the director of that area since I've been here, has retired as of tomorrow. He's retired. He, not surprisingly, took a couple of days of vacation. So he's now, he is not with us today. I have promoted Diana Ramos into that new director position. She has been in that area for years. And so we're really lucky to have that continuity of leadership. And so I'm really excited about our continued success in that area. So from there, we'll go on into looking at kind of a roll-up of the complaints for this year. Big roll-up is 1,237 complaints received of administrative violations. I want to look at the break those down. We have about 68% of them, or 835, that were external complaints, and then 32%, or 402, that were received internally. So other program areas within DWC referred possible administrative violations to the unit for investigation. Kind of break those down into big kind of buckets, just to kind of give you an idea of what we're talking about. The biggest bucket, of course, is communications. You see that 416 of the complaints fit into that communications bucket. Those communications are things like failure of an insurance carrier to timely respond to an injured employee's request, kind of those types of things. Failure to notify DWC of an injured employee and the injured employee of an action occurring on a claim within 10 days. So those are the of taking that action. Those are the things that fit in that big communications bucket. We also, I want to talk about the confirmed complaints. So we closed 1,255 complaints during this year. Confirmed complaints are the ones that were investigated, and if there was a confirmed administrative violation upheld by the investigation, all those are referred to enforcement for analysis and prosecution. And 330 were DWC education complaints. And so really what those were, those were complaints that were not a direct violation, more of a, it either didn't fit into our area or it was a dispute, it fit into another area. And so we educate folks to say, hey, this isn't an administrative violation. This is a dispute process. This should be a dispute. So we send out those education letters. Also, if we do prioritize our investigations, we're statutorily required to prioritize what we investigate, because if you look through the labor code and the administrative code, there are about possible a little bit over 400 types of administrative violations that could be triggered through actions by system participants. Not all those are of equal value. So we are required to prioritize them based on the risk to the system overall and to injured employees. Not surprisingly, one of our highest priorities, of course, are any administrative violation that impacts the benefits to the injured employee. And then 537 were not confirmed violations. Next slide. Oh, I do want to mention just with the slides that we do have a performance measure that we're supposed to process our complaints within 110 days, an average of 110 days. We're about at 73 days now. So we're doing really good on getting to those really quickly and making determinations. So the next is we just kind of give a little bit further dig down into the complaints and what they look like and who they're against. That's respondent type. Obviously, big players in our system are insurance carriers and healthcare providers. The most of the complaints for the communications bucket are against insurance carriers and indemnity benefits and medical benefits. So we're gonna see the complaints against insurance carriers and healthcare providers, communications also, and then medical benefits. So not real surprising with how that's broken down. Next slide. So talk about audits next. So the audit team performs audits. Next slide. So our audits are, we completed 59 audits during the fiscal year 22. The audits, we have a performance measure to complete audits within 180 days, and we're about 147 days, so we're meeting that performance measure to complete those audits in a timely manner. So what do we look at? Our audits have been for the last couple of years. We've looked at actually more than a couple of years. We've looked at the same things on our audits, and we've done death benefit. And it's a death benefit and lifetime income benefit audits. We did 25, initiated 25 of those this year. We canceled one because it didn't fit the number of the types of claims. Although our EDI showed that they fit into this category, they actually didn't. We completed 24 of those. I'm gonna come back to those death benefit audits here in a minute. We'll just real quickly touch on the initial payment of TIBS. It's the initial and accurate payment of TIBS. We did 11 of those in the medical bill processing. We did 11 TIBS, and then we did another 7. So we don't open the complaints, open these audits all at the same time. We roll them out over the entire year two tiers, and the same thing with the medical processing. So let's talk a little bit more about the death benefit audits. We've been doing these since about 2013. What we look at is we go back to deaths or injuries that occur to 2005. So some pretty old claims that we're looking at. And we look at the accuracy of the benefits that are being paid to the beneficiaries. We have consistently found that there are underpayments to death benefit beneficiaries in our system. This past year, we have, completed 24 of those audits. In the audits, there were 17 were found, in 17 of those audits, we found underpayments. In four of the audits, their underpayments were in excess of $100,000. So there was multiple claims within each one of those audits, but obviously a significant, but we looked at 75 claims. And of the 75 claims, there were 34 had underpayments to beneficiaries or underpayments. The lifetime income benefits, obviously there's much smaller number of those that we look at. We've had six LIB claims that we looked at, and four of those, there were underpayments. So what are the underpayments? What are we looking at? What are we seeing the cause of those underpayments? I know I've mentioned this in a couple of our meetings before, but we're seeing everything from a failure to obtain a wage statement when to improperly calculating the wage statement on its face is not complete, doesn't have 13 weeks. So basically the average weekly wage is being computed based on 1 week because it's the only week that's there. Just math errors. When you do the, we do the math. So the forms are all there, but when you redo the math doesn't equal. So it's an underpaying and there's not enough being paid. For another error is paying us at 70% as opposed to 75%. Then failure to include non-pecuniary wages in the average weekly wage. A lot of times they're just not included. There are other questions haven't been asked. Not too long ago, I saw a wage statement where the when it said non-pecuniary, it wasn't just left blank, there was question marks. So the employer put question marks, literally question marks in there, and the carrier didn't go back and ask, well, do you have questions about that? About what the average weekly wage was. Let's see what else. Underpayments to the SIF. When appropriate, making those under those excess payments in that weeks in excess of the remainder of the 364 days, making those payments to the SIF, and sometimes just no wage statement at all. So those are the kinds of things we're seeing now for the LIBs. It's really a lot of times it's just not paying the increase the. The 3% annual increase in the LIBS payment. So we're seeing these a lot. We've initially, when we started these audits, we were thinking that we would be way done by this time. We wouldn't have to continue doing the audits. We've moved to where the audits that we're doing, some of the carriers have two or three or four deaths, and that's it. So it's really a very few, but we're still finding significant underpayments. We've encouraged carriers to self-audit and to go back and look at these, look at the mistakes I'm talking about, and look at the files to make sure that we're paying the right benefits. Not everyone's taking us up on that self-audit, but we would encourage you to please self-audit and to let us know when you self-audit. I also encourage you that if you decide to self-audit, that you let us know if you have any questions or you want to know what kinds of things we're looking for, what questions we're going to ask from a self-audit. As I mentioned, Diana Ramos is the new director over that area. She has done these for years and she is a great resource. So please feel comfortable in talking to her about these death benefit audits and what we're kind of looking for in a self-audit. Just as this, when I talk about priorities as far as enforcement goes, this is one of our top priorities, is that these are being paid correctly. We see these underpayments as significantly impacting the, our system. So if anyone has questions about that, please let me know, but I just wanted to really look at the numbers for those. Next. So performance-based oversight, that's also in my area. So performance-based oversight for carriers, most of y'all probably know, hey, we're in the middle of it. Actually, we're towards the end of it. So next slide. So it was the methodology paper was posted in January of 2022. There were no changes from the last year, the last time that we performed a PBO assessment for carriers, in that we were assessing the same things. We were looking at the timely payment of initial TIBS, and it was weighted at 50%, and the associated EDI with that information at 5%. The timely processing of medical bills was weighted at 30%, and timely processing of medical bill reconsideration at 10%, and associated EDI with those with the medical processing at 5%. So there's not been significant change in the weights. And just to kind of remind folks, we cheer folks as a high, average, or poor performers. A high performer is 95 or above. And that's a high performer. And normally, if a high performer, one of the benefits of being a high performer in our system is that you're not subject to audits, just a normal audit. Now, the statute and the rules would allow us to audit if we see an issue, and they give us that flexibility if we need to audit or if we have a reason to audit. But that's a great benefit for being a high performer at 95% or above. Because I realize that our audits do take time for folks. That takes some of your resources for you to respond to the, our request for audits. So that is a benefit. And average is 80 to 94.99. And then a poor performer is below 80. We did look at the period that we're looking at for these. Preliminary findings in the memo books were issued to the carrier and sent to the Austin carrier, representative in the SFTP box August 5th. Next slide. So what do we want you to do? And if Martha, if you're around, if I mess something, please, by all, you can jump in to if I mess something with what we want folks to do, but acknowledging the receipt of the preliminary findings in that email, we really want folks to do that. I think that we're tracking to make sure that folks have responded. I'll let you know that we in this assessment, there are about 19 carriers that we had that have 19 additional carriers that 19 more carriers number wise that have been assessed than we normally have assessed. But of those, about 18 of them have never had a PBO, have never been involved in PBO before. So maybe they're, I encourage folks to follow the directions and ask questions or reach out. But we do need folks to let us know that they've gotten the findings. Then we view all the tabs in the workbook. So we send you a workbook and we review the tabs for those initial findings, initial assessment. And if you disagree with one of the findings, then you fill it out through the workbook and send that back to us. If there you don't have any concerns with the findings, if you're a high performer and you're 95, then you don't have to do anything else. You're done. But we need those responses back by September 9. Next slide. So this talks a little bit about, so it shows you the little workbook and that there's all the little tabs in the bottom. I guess it's opening up in Excel, all those little tabs in the bottom. So there's a tier rating, there's a detailed list of the late of filings and what was found. And then there's there are the areas, the tabs that you then fill in to disagree and send back to us. Next slide. Then, so what's the next steps? By September 19th, it's final. If we don't get paid, if we don't get something back, we got to close these out. So by September 9th, that's the deadline to respond. If we don't see anything, then that's your final score. And anything that is received by that deadline is September 9th, we will review and make determinations based on that. And we'll do the results will be published at the end of the year. Now we publish the results at the end of the year. We publish them on the website. We don't do the exact score, but we do publish it high average or low performer is what is put on the website. So if you have any questions, here's a great place to go to this link to ask the question. You'll find the folks that are very knowledgeable about PBO will answer any of your questions. Next slide. So now my area is fraud, the DWC Fraud and Prosecutions Unit. Next slide. just to kind of wrap up our numbers, we've had 751 fraud referrals received. Those are basic complaints that are received alleging fraud. A lot of those complaints, and some of those complaints don't allege fraud that we can do anything about, that we're authorized or to investigate or, but so we don't open those. We do, we also, some of those are ones that on the face of the referral itself, even if everything was true in there, it doesn't reach the level of a criminal act. Some of those are a criminal act within our system. So we don't open all investigations, and we have to select which ones we do open. And once again, it's based on the risk, and it's also based on the impact, perceived impact on our system, and whether or not we think we can be successful in a prosecution if we can prove those facts. So we opened up 58 fraud cases, and 71, we closed 71. We've got 2 fraud referrals. Next. So for our indictments, we have 1 injured employee indictment for fraud. That is what we, I guess, colloquially call working and drawing. So someone who has a workers' compensation claim, and they are receiving workers' compensation benefits, and also working at another job and accepting benefits that they weren't entitled to. We also have 1 employer fraud indictment. That employer fraud indictment is those are the types. This specifically one was a premium fraud where applying for a policy after an injury, a significant injury had occurred. And then of course, not telling the carrier about it. Next slide. Had 4 convictions, 1 healthcare provider, an injured employee working and drawing, and employer, and 2 employers for premium fraud. Next slide. Real quick, the enforcement update. So our enforcement, I said the after ANI does their investigations of administrative violations, if they have a confirmed violation, they send it to enforcement for their review and their analysis, and the enforcement are attorneys. Next slide. So let's look at our numbers for enforcement. Our enforcement cases, we have, so this says that we have opened, that we have pending 407 and closed 325. My director, Nikki, sent me a quick message before. She said, hey, no, wait, we now have, we've actually opened 579 throughout the year, and we closed 576. Last day of the fiscal year, she's was still working every day. But so this was our slide is a little bit outdated. Next slide. Cases pending by subject matter. So let's go ahead and break these cases down a little bit more in detail. 81 of our cases are against healthcare providers, and 320 against insurance carriers, and 6 others. Others can be everything from attorneys to employers, other folks within our system. Next slide. The close type, 85 healthcare provider cases were closed, insurance carriers were 231, and other 9. Next slide. Let's look at those a little bit by the disposition of those when we close those down. So for against the insurance carrier, 115 of those were resolved with an order, and 23 against the insurance carriers, healthcare providers were closed with an order. While 110 of the administrative violations were closed with warning letters against insurance carriers, and 56 for healthcare providers, and then those other. Next slide. So here we do post all the disciplinary orders on the website, and we in their entirety. If there happens to be something in there that would indicate that is confidential, we would redact that. But everything else is put up in their entirety, and here's the link to it. So I encourage you to look at those orders if you're at all interested in them. Next slide. So that's the end of my presentation, except I do want to let you know that we are going through a complete process review for the areas. We've done that we do continual process review. We're looking at I know that Diana is taking this opportunity as a new leader to look at the areas and look at audits and different ways to do those audits and to be more efficient with the audits. One of the questions that I kind of had for the group, and you don't have to answer it right now, but if anybody would like to in the chat or get in contact with me later, is if there are some of our audits are done, we still have for the claim files, we're looking at claim file audits. And so I think some carriers still print out information from the claim file and then fax it to us. And that seems to be a fairly, and I'll let you know what we do is we get them faxed and then we scan them into our system. So we make it, y'all start off electronic, I'm assuming, then you print them out, then you send them to us fax, then we print them out those ways. There might be a more efficient way to do those. And we're looking at, for those carriers that do that, maybe potentially having access to claim files and seeing if there was a way to do it that way. I know we've tried that in the past. It didn't work really well because it was pretty clunky, but we're really open to looking at maybe, making audits even more streamlined and more efficient. Questions? Comments? Okay, with that, then I'll go ahead and pass it on to, I think, Mary's next. Yes.
Thank you, Deborah. Good afternoon, everybody. So today, as you can see, I'm wearing the hat of director for the designated doctor program. And as such, my presentation will focus on three designated doctor topics. The first topic is regarding proposed changes to Chapter 127 and Rule 180.23. Many of you may know that over the summer, a second informal proposal was made that addressed the following topics: certification, training, and testing requirements, the TBI qualifications, multiple impairment ratings, and the DWC-68 form. Comments that were received have been reviewed, and if you submitted comments, we certainly appreciate your feedback. We are in the process of drafting a formal proposal addressing the input that we received. While I don't have a specific timeline for you, I will say that our goal is to have these specific rules adopted by the end of this calendar year. So stay tuned for more information. The second topic that I'd like to talk to you about is the much anticipated billing and reimbursement informal rule. So you might have noticed that the informal proposal was announced last week. Okay, if you have not seen that proposal, I invite you to visit our rule webpage where you will find 5 documents associated with the informal proposal. The first document, it's a memo announcing the proposal, but the memo is important because it contains information about a upcoming stakeholder meeting next week, which I'll provide a little bit more information in just a second. The second document are the proposed amendments to certain sections of Chapter 133. The third document, proposed amendments to certain sections of Chapter 134. Then there's also a table that we have provided for you that contains current language, proposed language, and notes about those proposed changes. And then finally, we also have a document that provides designated doctor exam billing examples showing how the CMS 1500 form is being filled out today based on current rules, and how that form would be filled out with the proposed changes, assuming that those changes are adopted. So the comment period for these set of informal rules ends September 23rd. So that stakeholder presentation that I mentioned earlier, it is scheduled next week, September the 8th at 1:30 via Zoom. And the goal there is really for us, for staff to discuss the amendments to the rules, the language, and obtain feedback from you regarding those proposed changes. So we hope we will see you then. So a couple of just a few things that I do want you to keep in mind as you review these proposed changes. First of all, these billing requirements for designated doctor billing and others involved, I can tell you that they're very technical in nature and they can become very complex very quickly, which is part of the reason why we provided all those documents for you to make it easier as you review the proposed changes. And because of the technical nature, our focus really with this first and formal is to focus on the billing structure. So in case you haven't reviewed those rules, you will notice that the proposed fees are not on this proposal. That doesn't mean that we're not going to increase fees or they're going to stay the same. It just simply means that we're really trying to focus on the billing structure, okay? The goal is to address the billing structure first before we address the reimbursement. And then really the last thing that I want you to keep in mind as you review these this informal proposal is that I know we keep calling it a designated doctor rule, and it is true, it does affect the designated doctors, but the proposed changes will also impact RME doctors and doctors authorized to certify MMI and assigned impairment ratings, whether as a treating doctor or a referral doctor. So as for my final topic to discuss with you today is regarding the upcoming text comp enhancements that will mostly affect designated doctors. Over the last few months, we have announced that changes were coming to text comp. Well, we finally last week announced that those changes will go into effect Monday, September the 19th, so just around the corner. So these enhancements will mostly affect designated doctors, and in my opinion, really in a positive way, because they will have the ability to manage their appointments via their text comp profile. So currently today, the division makes those offers by faxing those forms to designated doctors or their scheduling companies. The designated doctors then in return provide us their responses, whether they decline the appointment or accept the appointment by faxing the forms again. And so this enhancement in essence gets rid of the faxing. So we're very excited about that. Another enhancement of this text comp project is allowing designated doctors to submit requests for assistance when medical records haven't been received from the carriers or from the treating doctors prior to the designated doctor exam. They will also be able to submit their request for additional time to submit their designated doctor report. And the other thing that we think it's also pretty cool and very excited about is that the designated doctors will be able to file through text comp their narrative reports along with any forms associated with the narrative report, like the 68, the 69, and the 73 forms. And so there, we do have a series of training sessions that will be held in the next couple of weeks with the focus of training the designated doctors and their scheduling companies, but also reaching out to RME doctors and doctors authorized to certify MMI and assigned impairment ratings. But if you're interested about hearing more on the topic, certainly feel free. I invite you to go out to the designated doctor homepage where we have a lot of information about the enhancements coming up. So this concludes my presentation. I'll answer any questions you may have, unless we're gonna, I think we're also gonna have a Q&A at the end of the meeting. Questions? Okay, so hearing none, I'm gonna turn it over to Martha Lueveno, Director of Enterprise Automation Services. Martha.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to just give a quick updates on claims ADI release 3.1 and then just give you a little loop you guys in on some of the other changes that we're planning for text comp. Carrier forms update. So we're continuing to follow up with insurance carriers through their carrier representatives to update and validate the contact information that is in text comp. So you'll notice that there's been several staff that have been reaching out to the carrier reps and sort of giving y'all time to gather that information from your carriers. So That's going well, and hopefully we can get that wrapped up in the next couple of weeks. We're also doing a project on self-insured governmental entities to collect any outdated or tardy 20SIs. 20SIs are the forms that the governmental entities that self-insure, they're required to file those to let us know that they still have coverage. Any questions regarding those forms are going to be directed to coverage verification. Next slide. Claims EDI 3.1 reminder. So we are 135 days, 18 hours, 43 minutes and counting to testing for claims EDI 3.1. So that's not that much time for us to get a whole bunch of information together from insurance carriers. So I wanted to just give you all a quick reminder and just let you know how we're planning on following up with maybe the stuff that we still have missing. So EDI staff will be reaching out to carriers that have not completed the claim compliance coordinator part of the EDI 03, because that's new. The trading partner registration with Verisk, and also those that have not completed the billing registration. Now, obviously that's three very different kind of registrations or reporting. So over the next couple of months, I'm assigning individual staff to a group of carriers, and they'll act as a single point of contact for all three of these issues. So we wanna be respectful of everybody's time, carriers and carrier representatives. So hopefully this will, following up on all three items for the carriers that are missing, you know, one or the other, both or all three, hopefully we'll be able to serve that purpose, you know, our purposes of collecting the data without, you know, bombarding you with information from different sources. So I'd appreciate your assistance. You know, we're always going to need the carrier representatives' help, you know, just to kind of wrap up maybe a few stragglers that we have on each one of these topics. So when as you think about New Year's Day, and if there's countdown clocks to New Year's Day, you add 11 days to that day, and that's when testing starts. So that's when we're going to have all this information with us. So we will be approaching this with a sense of urgency, but we will be as respectful as possible of your time. Right, next slide. Questions about the EDI portions, claim EDI 3.1 coverage, all of those topics. I'm not going to read them out. Just go ahead and email me, and I'll be happy to help. I have a second part of the of my presentation that has to do with something completely different than EDI. This is really just about system improvements and our continuing efforts at the DWC to make things easier for stakeholders to get things to us. So really, this is more of a presentation to loop you in on another feature of TexComp. Next slide. Which allows stakeholders to upload any document 24 hours a day into TexComp and direct it to the appropriate party. Now understanding that everybody on this call has an SFTP route that they usually file their documents, and that is still the preferred method probably for everybody, but we wanted to loop you in on this particular feature in the event that it may become useful, or maybe you can refer somebody that's trying to get us something by fax and maybe they're having trouble. They can use this feature to upload documents. So there are some technical specifications to use this particular feature in TexComp. First is that you must have a TexComp login. We do accept 4 different types of files: Word, Excel, PDF, and TIFF, but nothing else. There's a file size limit of 10 kilobytes. Compressed or zip files cannot be accepted this way. And multiple files that are uploaded at the same time cannot have the same name. Otherwise, that all of these things, if they're not followed, will cause a failure. Next slide. So how do you file online? You go to TexComp, you log on, you look for upload documents on the TexComp left-hand menu. You upload your forms and documents in the category that applies, and then you click submit. one of the nice things about this new feature in TextComp is that it will return an acknowledgement with detailed information on when that upload was accepted. Next slide. This is just a sample of what that screen might look like. This isn't the final, but the upload screen will generally give you some categories. You click on the button that says select files to get the files out of your internal system and upload them to us. And I'll bring your attention to the last two categories that say any DWC form and any document type. So it's very, very general. As long as it's one of those four formats and you have a login, you should be able to get us almost anything. Now the file names are important for us to be able to route the documents to the right place or to send them to the right claim. So file names with a form number, document type, a claim number, some other kind of identifying information, you know, because this is a secure system, we would be able to take some of that identifying information will help us route the documents to the right place. Next slide. And if you use this upload feature, you'll get a nice acknowledgement that you can print and save with enough detail that you would be able to, you know, share that if there's any questions about when those documents were filed. Okay, that is all I have. If there are any questions about the new feature in TextComp, there are two contacts. If you have trouble uploading documents, you send an email to eFilingHelp. If you have problems logging in, or if you are not sure how to create a TextComp login, you go to TextComp Help. That's all I had. Are there any questions so far? Okay, thank you all for your attention.
Hello, everybody. My name is Greg Arndt. I am the Director for Medical Fee Dispute Resolution. And today I was going to go over the number and types of disputes that we've received in fiscal year 2022. We are at the last day of the fiscal year today, so I'm going to go over those today. Next slide. The healthcare providers have kept us pretty busy here these last couple of days. Instead of 2,666 disputes received, it's up to 2,825 disputes received. So we've gotten a lot in here in the past 2 days. So the top three types of disputes that we received this past year are going to be division specific disputes, and that's mostly designated doctor exams. It also does include chronic pain management and other types of medical services. The second most is going to be the professional services. Those are your evaluation and management doctor visit services. And then the third is going to be the facility. That's going to be your outpatient and inpatient hospital services. Those are our top three disputes in fiscal year 2022. That has been pretty consistently for the past 10 years, the top three types of disputes, with the exception of 2017 to 2019, when pharmacy blew up basically. So those top three, there are 60% of the actual disputes that we have received are those types. Pharmacy was the fourth most common. We did receive 386 pharmacy disputes this year. In comparison to 2017 to 2019, we were receiving 1,500 to 2,000 disputes per year. The change was because we were receiving a lot of disputes for compounded medications, and there was an update to the Texas Administrative Code that we did make that basically lessened the disputes to where now it's, instead of getting thousands in a year, we're into the mid to low hundreds, actually. So we also have received 179 air ambulance disputes this year. That's a little bit less than previous years, but it is still a sizable number. Just a reminder to everybody, starting in February of 2016, Commissioner Brannon at the time decided to abate all of the air ambulance disputes. Right now we have over 2,000 air ambulance disputes that are at MFDR that are abated at this time. Next slide. So for fiscal year 2022, we have closed 2,537 disputes. Again, the top three are going to be the top three that we had received, division specific, including designated doctor, professional, and facility. There are no air ambulance disputes in the closures because, again, those are all abated at this time. The performance measures that we're supposed to meet is within 200 days is when a dispute needs to be closed. At this time, we are at 75 days on average to process. Most of them are less than that. We get about 75 to 80% out within 75 days. We do have a couple that do take a little bit longer, which drives the average up a little bit. Of the closures in 2022, 49%, so almost half, were actually withdrawn by the healthcare provider. So the healthcare provider put in a dispute, we forwarded it to the insurance carrier decided they were going to pay for the disputed services. So almost half were actually withdrawn and did not require a decision or dismissal from MFDR. 21% were decisions with no orders. We said, no, you should not have to, the carrier should do not have to pay an additional amount. 22% were decisions with orders to pay. So it's about even on the numbers of orders and no orders that we for the decisions that we've been issuing. 8% were dismissals. Those were disputes that were not ripe for MFDR as of yet, or they should have gone through a different process at the division. They should have gone through the benefit review conference because there was a compensability extender liability issue as an example of that. That has gone down pretty significantly. Several years ago, our total dismissals were twice that. And so they were almost 20%. So we did do a lot of education and most of the dismissals are down to less than 10% of our total right now. Next slide.
With you today. I'm excited about the first the prospects of county insurance for both my
first. So went too far.
In the next week.
One back or two back. Slide 41 is what we're looking for. There we go. Okay, so this is just the our slide 41 is just going to be the total number of disputes received and closed per year. The only thing that I was going to point out there was in 2018 and 2019, going the wrong way again. There we go. One more. There you go. Okay. In 2018 and 2019, the total number of disputes that we received was over 5,000 each year. And again, that was because of the pharmacy actual disputes that we had received. So starting in 2020, we've kind of settled into the about 2,500 to 3,000 disputes received per year. And we close because we're working those as they come through. So next slide. Okay, so in 2021, MFDR put a new decision search tool. I think most people know about it, but I wanted to talk about it a little bit. Previously, before the search tool, the decisions, which we do have to post to the website, it was just a list of thousands of actual decisions, and it only had the MFDR tracking number. We were able to get this tool created, and you can actually search with the search bar by the five different or the five different fields we have. You can search by tracking number, date received, date issued, the requester, the healthcare provider, or the respondent actually. So it helps out a lot. Couple things on the actual search tool. It only has decisions that have been issued from 2014 to present. If the decisions that were issued from 2002 to 2014, we do have those in an archive. There are over 45,000 decisions that we keep in an archive, actually. And if you would like a decision that was issued at that time, just send us an email and we can go ahead and get you that decision. We'll get it to you within a day. It is decisions only. It's not dismissals or withdrawals. So if you're looking for something that was dismissed, it won't be in this actual web tool. And the last thing is there is about a month lag time between issuing a decision, which for carriers, we send you the decisions through your electronic rep box through SFTP. So, but there is usually about a month lag time between when we're going to send it to you through your rep box and when it's actually posted to the website on this tool. At this point, we have 17,447 actual decisions that are searchable through this tool on the website. Next slide. The last thing I wanted to talk about were the carrier responses. We get the dispute in, we send it to the carriers via their electronic rep box, and they have 14 days to respond. From 2018 to 2020, the carrier responses that were missing or untimely, again, you have the carriers have 14 days to respond to the disputes. It was either from 8 to 12% basically from 2018 to 2020. In 2021 and 2022, the number of missing or untimely responses jumped up to 20% actually. So, and it's been like that for 2 years now. So it is in the carrier's best interest to respond to disputes. If we do a decision without a response, it is with the healthcare provider's argument only. And the 20% number is actually probably a little bit higher in more valid responses, because a lot of the responses that we have been getting lately are a response saying, we're gonna send this back and we'll supplement this, our response. Often we never actually get that supplemental response. So again, it is in the carrier's interest to respond to the disputes. The one other thing about the carrier responses that we have seen started happening, say the carrier decides to pay for the disputed services. Sometimes they will only contact the healthcare provider and not the division. So the healthcare provider thinks it's the dispute is gone while it's still active here at the actual division. So if when you do respond, you are supposed to respond to both the to all parties, including the division. Most carriers still put in responses via fax or email. Some have started moving to the through the electronic rec box, the SFTP. As Martha was kind of talking about with the naming conventions for those, if the carriers do respond through the electronic rep box, you could have DWC-60 in the name of the document, the tracking number, MFDR, anything that allows the people who look at that to triage it to MFDR. We always get those responses, but sometimes they take the long way to get here, actually. So that's all I have. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, so I'll hand it off to the next person.
Apologize for those technical difficulties, everybody. I'm sorry about that. But there are no other questions for Greg. We will move on to some closing remarks from Commissioner Nelson.
Thank you. I did just want to echo a few things that were said during this meeting. As Deborah mentioned about death benefits and the audits that she's been doing, we really are seeing a lot of underpayments consistently. So we would really try to encourage you to self-audit, to try to, you know, self-evaluate and try to make up for those payments if you do find that you're missing those, you know, before we get a hold of those, because those are very important benefits in our system and it's going to be a focus of ours. Also, Mary talked about the designated doctor rules. We really have two rules going on. That first set that's been going on, two informals now that we've had about the training and testing and the qualifications. My intent is to get that adopted before the end of the calendar year. On the rules about the billing structure and the reimbursement, we're going to be a little bit more deliberative about that. Any time we're talking about reimbursement, there's a lot of focus on it. So we're going to go out. We have this informal proposal out now. We encourage you to look at that and to attend our September 8th virtual meeting on it. And then we will take a look at all the comments and feedback we get, make some changes to that. And then we'll go for another informal where we'll put some actual figures to it. Again, I think that's probably going to take a while for that process, but it is something I do want to keep moving forward. but I can't really give a solid time frame on it right now. And I did just want to say to Martha's point about the document upload, I do think it's very, I think it's very good, and it's a pretty significant change. Any stakeholder now is going to be able to create an account with us and send us documentation electronically. I know that's been a frustration for new system participants in the past, and as well as injured employees and even some ledge offices that I used to interact with. So I'm very happy about that change. That is September 19th. That's supposed to go into effect. It's a big system improvement for us and a big change. So we hope it all goes smoothly, but if there are any problems that or hiccups that you see, you know, please let Martha and her team know, and we will, you know, try to get that thing working as smoothly as possible as quickly as we can. And, you know, before we sign off, are there any last minute questions or thoughts from anyone on here? All right. Well, then I guess we appreciate your time, and we'll see you at the next one.